It is Monday, November 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, at least 31 people have died in wildfires in California. A deadly suicide bombing rocks Kabul, Afghanistan. And we look at two new films exploring gay rights, past and present. It's all ahead. Wildfires are raging in both northern and southern California, with the infernos barely contained and strong winds and dry conditions in the forecast. The death toll is at least 31 and is likely to increase as rescue workers reach vast regions left in charred ruins. VOA's Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan tells me about the Camp Fire in the northern part of the state, which is burning north of the state capital, Sacramento.
Well, they say it's 25% controlled. So with these fires, it's a question of, you know, what they typically do is set back fires and burn out the brush to stop the fire from moving. And when they eventually contain it, it's not out, but it will essentially burn up everything in that containment area. So they say they are 25% contained, but it's been a destructive fire. 45,000 hectares scorched so far. The entire town, practically, of Paradise, a town of about 26 or 27,000 people, wiped out. And, of course, it's been one of the deadliest fires in the state's history.
Getting further south, in Southern California, you got two fires going there, the Woolsey Fire and the Hill Fire. And the Woolsey Fire destroyed something. I just happened to run into this on Twitter, a Paramount Western town, which was, I think, a set used in a number of perhaps movies and TV shows over the years. That's in, I believe, the Agora area. And that's all the Woolsey Fire.
That's right. And that area out toward Agora, those, you know, hilly wilderness areas about, an hour outside of Los Angeles, it's you know, sets like that, locations like that, that brought the movie industry to California, because you don't have to go out of the city very far to get wilderness areas that are just perfect for Westerns. So that site has been used since the 30s and the 40s. A Bob Hope movie was done there. Western serials like The Cisco Kid in the 1950s, Westworld, and just one movie after another, anytime they needed a Western-looking town, because it's just been sitting there on the property and it would be rented out to filmmakers. So going back, 70 or more years.
And then what about the Hill Fire?
The Hill Fire is about 75% contained. That's a much smaller fire. So that one is just about under control. The Woolsey Fire, which is the largest one, which has burned across the freeway and burned down to the coast through Malibu and drove so many celebrities, as we've heard, from their homes, burned down many mansions up there, that is just 20% contained. And officials are especially worried about that fire because the Santa Ana winds, which are the dry winds that come in from the east, from the desert, gusty and unpredictable, they're expected to pick up again on Tuesday. And that makes the conditions very tough for firefighters trying to create a fire break.
Well, in addition, President Donald Trump, he has been tweeting about this, and he has said that the forest management has not done a good job, and I think has been, you know, critical of some of California fire officials.
Well, you know, when you talk to fire officials year after year, what they tell you is that some years ago, there was an attempt, which is now viewed as misguided, to suppress all forest fires. And for many years, as far as I'm aware, fire officials have been saying fire is part of the natural ecosystem, and so it has to be allowed to go through and clear out the dense underbrush, the dead trees. And if it doesn't, you get these conflagrations. So I think all, you know, firefighting officials are aware of this. It was a major shift, and quite a few years ago, to trying to deal with fires and accept them as being a necessary part of the, as I said, the ecosystem. So I'm not quite sure what he's talking about, because the approach has been the one he's advocating, current forest management. One thing I've heard is that firefighters have just not had the money to, the resources to deal with all these small fires. So much has gone into crisis management with the major fires that they haven't been able to allow the brush to be cleared, either mechanically or through these smaller control fires that they ideally should have. So I think that that's going to be an ongoing discussion with both the state and federal lands where these fires burn. How are they going to get the resources and the money to control these fires, thin out the vegetation so that we don't have these major conflagrations every year now.
VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reporting from Los Angeles. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. U.S. vote counting continues in the state of Florida. The IAEA says Iran is still abiding by its nuclear deal. The United States and the European Union call the election in the pro-Russian area of eastern Ukraine a sham. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada says his country has heard a recording of journalist Khashoggi's death. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA reports that its Parker solar probe recently brushed past the sun, getting to within 24 million kilometers of its surface. The space agency says that it is the first spacecraft to get so close to the sun. Mission controllers at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab say they received a status beacon from the spacecraft that indicates it's operating well after its solar flyby. They also report that as it reached its closest point to the sun so far, the spacecraft reached a speed of a little over 343,000 kilometers per hour. Before its mission ends in about 6 years, the Parker space probe is expected to get to within 6 million kilometers from the sun's surface. The spacecraft was launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida at 0731 UTC on August 12th. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, international organizations express concerns for the civilian population of Yemen. We'll have a report. In Afghanistan, officials say at least six people were killed in a suicide blast in central Kabul Monday. VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim is in Islamabad, Pakistan, tells me about the explosion.
Well, what we do know now is that the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility, their local affiliate, the Islamic State Khorasan province. And what happened was that the attack happened at a site which literally less than an hour ago had been a site of a protest. These spontaneous protests, at least according to local Afghan media and their TV channel Tolo News, started overnight. The Taliban last week had attacked two districts, particularly areas which are majority Hazara populated. Hazaras are a Shiite minority. They've usually been under attack. They have distinctive features, so it's very easy to recognize them and say whether they're Shiite or Sunni, because almost all Hazaras or most Hazaras are Shiites. And so there were protests about not protecting these two provinces in Afghanistan and particularly those districts, and the protests just mushroomed overnight. And from a few people, it became a few hundred people. They marched to the presidential palace. They were in this area protesting, and then President Ghani called them and reassured them that reinforcements will be sent, and they dispersed. And literally, you know, half an hour or more after that, a suicide bomber blew himself up, killing six people, at least six people that we know of, wounding many more, 20 or more people. The six included three men, you know, two women, and one person from the security forces. So that's what we know about the attack so far.
Well, now, the earlier attacks that this group had, Hazara, had been districts where the Hazara, where there has been violence, those attacks apparently had been conducted by the Taliban, not by Islamic State. Is that correct?
Yes. Although I have to point out that most attacks in Kabul on Hazaras have been carried out by the Islamic State. So the attacks on the Hazara areas, the Islamic State actually targets Shiites. Taliban lately have not been targeting Shiites particularly, but Taliban have been fighting with almost all of government forces almost across the country. So at this point, it would be hard to say whether the attacks in those districts carried out by Taliban were directed towards the Shiites or they were just attacks. Whereas with the Islamic State, they've claimed more attacks on Shiites, so we know that they go after this particular minority group.
Overall, does it seem that the security situation in Afghanistan is in decline?
Yes, it does. And the thing is that more and more areas, there was a Wall Street Journal story that said the Taliban are in control of more area than they ever were since they were ousted from power in 2001. And if you look at the map of Afghanistan and describe it as a Swiss cheese, the government-controlled areas would be the holes in the cheese and the Taliban-influenced areas would be the rest of the cheese. So the security situation is deteriorating. The urban centers still are in government control. Rural area is primarily under either Taliban control or influence. But yes, the security situation is getting worse. But as American generals describe it, it's a stalemate. So the Taliban have not been able to attack and hold a city, although they have been able to carry out attacks almost at will.
And there still is, I guess, a clear division between the Taliban and Islamic State. They are not allies. They are not cooperating with each other.
At least on the higher level, there is a very clear distinction between Taliban and the Islamic State. And in many areas, the Taliban have been fighting the Islamic State. So they have they're almost in a territorial dispute, the two of them. Although some people suggest in the Afghan intelligence and otherwise that on a lower level, on the operational level, there may be some cooperation in certain parts of the country, but it's definitely not across the board. And in many parts of the country, the Taliban are fighting the Islamic State.
VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim reporting from Islamabad, Pakistan. The fighting for control of the key Yemeni port city of Hodeidah between Gulf Coalition pro-government forces and Houthi rebel defenders has moved to some residential neighborhoods, causing dozens of casualties, including civilians. The UN and aid groups fear the assault on the Red City port city, entry point for 80% of the country's food imports and relief supplies that began November 1st, could trigger famine. Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in a phone call with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, called for a cessation of hostilities and negotiated peaceful solution to the conflict. Robert Palladino, a State Department spokesman, addressed the matter in a news briefing last week.
We've been urging all parties to come to the table and to recognize that there's no military victory that can be achieved in Yemen. And we continue to call for a cessation of hostilities and for all parties to support United Nations Special Envoy Martin Griffiths in finding a peaceful solution to the conflict.
Palladino said the U.S. considers the destruction of critical infrastructure and interruption of the delivery of vital aid and commercial goods as totally unacceptable. Zubair Iqbal is a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty both sides appear to be trying to strengthen their positions ahead of anticipated UN-sponsored negotiations, but the ferocity of the attacks may actually disrupt the prospect for talks. He also said the fighting comes amid changes in the region.
What we see today is that the Saudi coalition is afraid that they're not going to get as much support as they were expecting or as they have had in the past. And because that support will be lacking, and as you already know, that the mid-air refueling has been basically terminated. So under these circumstances, they want to speed up the process and be as aggressive as possible. And on the other side, Houthis also realize it, and they're doing the same thing. But in the process, something very seriously wrong has happened. One is that the Houthis are actually very seriously considering, as far as I understand, the missile attacks on the UAE as well as on Saudi Arabia. And under the new revised conditions or changed conditions, strategic conditions in the region, these kinds of attacks may not be condemned as much as they were condemned in the past. That's dangerous. The second issue that I'm afraid of is that the increasing conflict between the two and leading to a much larger loss of human life could very well give some degree of support to the Al-Qaeda. So we have a very awkward situation on our hands. The participants are trying to strengthen their position in order to seek negotiations, if possible, under the UN system. The Americans want to move in order to make sure that that happens and is successful. Third position is that the strategic position in that region has weakened, and American involvement and interest has to be stronger if it wants to preserve its own national interest.
How much does the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi play in the Saudi efforts to speed up the offensive?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I didn't want to mention it very expressly, but that's basically the idea, that ever since that tragic death of Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi position has weakened. And they know that any subsequent negotiation that may take place will not necessarily be on their terms. So in order to compensate for that, they want to speedily reach a stage where the ground realities would tend to help them.
The UN Special Envoy Martin Griffiths said he hopes to convene renewed peace talks by year's end. Is there any prospect of that?
Yeah, it's going to happen. If the U.S. involvement, along with the European involvement, becomes so strong that they can break on the actions of the Saudi coalition, then you might be in a position to negotiate. And that may actually give rise to a situation where compromises might be possible.
Zubair Iqbal of the Middle East Institute. Hodeida is viewed as a main supply line for the Houthi rebels, and wresting control from them would force them to return to the negotiating table. The World Food Programme said so far its grain silos have been spared in the latest fighting, and last week announced its intention to double its food assistance program for Yemen to reach up to 14 million people to avoid mass starvation. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Conversion therapy and social exile for being gay is the subject of two award-winning independent films this season. The Happy Prince by Rupert Everett and Boy Erased by Joel Edgerton are based on real-life stories of gay men treated as pariahs by their communities. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the filmmakers and authors of the stories about the challenges gays and lesbians continue to face.
Oscar Wilde, the sentence of the court is that you be imprisoned and kept to hard labor for 2 years.
In 1897, literary giant Oscar Wilde has fallen from grace for his openly romantic homosexual relationship with Lord Alfred Douglas. After a 2-year prison sentence, he emerges a human wreck, impoverished and ostracized from society.
Not wearing your silk stockings today, Oscar.
You go too far, sir.
No, you go too far.
Rupert Everett, an openly gay director, scriptwriter, and actor, directed and scripted the film and interprets Wilde. He says he wanted to show that in 19th century England, no man, not even a recognized figure such as Oscar Wilde, was impervious to social rejection for being homosexual. Rupert Everett says though the film harkens to a different era, it serves as a reminder that despite progress in the West, gays around the world still face discrimination and persecution.
It's a good reminder of what can happen, even in our countries, with the waves of populism that are kind of rolling over us. So I feel it really is a film for Trump's America, in a way, I hope.
Garrett Conley, a gay author who wrote the memoir-turned-movie Boy Erased about being forced to undergo gay conversion therapy after coming out to his conservative Baptist family in Arkansas, echoes Rupert Everett's warning.
This rather insidious idea that was implanted in us from, you know, basically birth, which is that to be openly LGBTQ meant that you were either a predator or you were going to be beaten or you were going to end up dying of AIDS. And those were the stories that we were told.
You want to say goodbyes?
Welcome to the refuge program.
You cannot be born a homosexual. This is a lie. It's a choice.
Jared, God will not love you the way that you are.
Joel Edgerton plays a conversion therapist who uses pseudoscience, shaming, and torture to treat his patients. Edgerton directed the film and wrote the script. He says he made Boy Erased to bring to light the mistreatment and dehumanization young people encounter in these conversion programs.
I challenge people who are running these programs, and there are a large percentage of people who work as staff in these programs who identify as ex-gay or know in their core that the reason they're there is because they're trying to help repress their own sexuality, is to really tune in to the fact that is it really working for themselves? And why, if it's not inherently working for themselves, are they then trying to push these ideas onto other kids?
What you're going through right now is just a moment.
A moment.
Yeah.
A moment.
I love God and I love my son. For your father, it's a little more complicated.
We are not finished.
I am, because you won't listen.
Conley says his story is not about villains or heroes. It is about dismantling misconceptions and helping young gay people find their voice.
At the day's end, we get to choose how we love, when we love, what we do with our lives. And no one gets to tell you how to do that.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Susan Yawkey of VOA's International Edition. VOA's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of some of the world's greatest experts on international issues. But you don't have to tune in at broadcast time. Listen when you want. Just go to